wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning. And this is KBO Portland, your community-owned and democratically run radio station. Welcome to the OMO Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Patsy Kohlberg is engineering. The OMO is dedicated to bringing you different perspectives on history, culture, and politics and current events than that of the corporate compromised news media. Today in our program, Denise Morris reads an article by Paul Street, What's Not Happening with Mr. Jones. Street argues that while the defeat of the embarrassing Roy Moore is a relief, Doug Jones is not likely to sprout progressive wings, but will follow in the footsteps of neoliberal centrist Democrats. I'll be giving a reading from an article by Gabriel Rockhill entitled, The U.S. is Not a Democracy. It Never Was. Concluding our program today, Jan Hocken talks with Katie Gentile, a professor of gender studies at John Jay College, about feminist politics, sexual harassment, and the Me Too campaign. Leading off today's program, Bill Resnick interviews Dina Floberg, a policy analyst at the organization Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. They work to promote universal access to open networks and protect free speech everywhere. Bill?
Hi. Thanks, Tom. And Dina Floberg, welcome to KBOO.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me.
So, Dina Floberg, tell us about Free Press, what they do, and particularly your role.
Right. So, at Free Press, we fight to have democratic, open media policies for the internet and more traditional media. That includes things like net neutrality, fighting media consolidation, and trying to promote universal and affordable access. As a policy analyst, I contribute to a lot of our legal research and legal writing as we fight for those kinds of policies inside Washington, D.C.
Uh-huh. Last week, we all suffered a setback under their new chairman, the FCC. New chairman's a Trump nominee, created a 3-2 Republican majority. The FCC voted to end net neutrality rules. Dina, in this interview, we're going to mostly discuss a good deal of how to regain not just the net neutrality rules, but to really advance ideas of free speech and free expression and participation in the great discussions and challenges that face the world. But first, why is net neutrality itself so important?
Well, net neutrality really effectively is the First Amendment of the Internet. It prevents these big Internet service providers like Comcast, AT&T, and Verizon from censoring or discriminating against content online that they don't like. Without net neutrality, it's possible for your Internet service provider to make it even harder for you to access some content online or to charge you more to do that. And what we've seen is that the Internet increasingly is an incredibly valuable platform for people to share their stories, to communicate with each other, for small and innovative businesses to start, and also for social movements to take root. We often see that marginalized voices, whether they be women, people of color, LGBTQ youth, disabled folks, don't have as much access to traditional media platforms. And so the Internet gives all of those voices the opportunity to tell their own stories and to organize for change. So losing net neutrality rules means that all of that potential and all of that freedom and openness is suddenly at risk.
Yeah, the Internet now has become our public sphere, and it's a public sphere that's international. In lots of ways, people can communicate in ways that they never were able to, and there's far more, in fact, sort of sophistication and understanding of things to the extent that alternative views can compete with the deluge of commercial media. There's increasing sophistication even in the most rural areas. In fact, that's another problem, isn't it, that whereas the big providers, AT&T and Verizon, have a monopoly, basically, and they justify it by saying, well, we're going to give universal service like the phone companies or other public utilities. In fact, they're not doing that. They're not investing in other – I mean, there's all kinds of communities that have either very slow service or no service at all from those monopoly providers.
Yeah, absolutely. And what we're seeing here is that that's part of how these big ISPs are trying to justify taking away net neutrality, is they're once again trying to sort of bribe policymakers and saying, if you take away this critical protection, this critical non-discrimination protection that consumers and internet users and activists really need, we promise that we will build out, we'll invest in these communities, we'll make sure that there's competition and access. But we've heard that line before. We hear it from corporate gatekeepers all over the place, that if we just give them free rein, then all of the benefits will eventually trickle down to people. And what we've seen is that never actually comes true.
Yeah, their profit needs, it seems to supersede their the great public commitments to the public service that they espouse through their lobbyists and through their paid media. My sense is that also it becomes a protection racket for the biggest companies with the deepest pockets. They may have to pay a little bit more, but they will be in first position always and be able to promise much faster service, right? You go on Amazon and you'll get to wherever you're going in a second and a half. But anybody competing, or even any small business that isn't sort of an Amazon on their part of their operation, it may take 10 seconds or 20 seconds or even more for anything, even if you try and get in touch with them, even to be able to get access to them. And they're just going to lose out as people, because people get accustomed to this very, very fast service.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. We see a lot of the ISPs and their lobbyists saying that this is just a fight between Comcast and Google or between Comcast and Amazon, and that's really not true. The people that most stand to be hurt by losing net neutrality rules are real people and small businesses and people who are trying to get their start, because you're right, they absolutely won't be able to pay whatever extra tolls the internet service provider asks them to pay in order to reach their customers or their communities and to really get their message across.
Yeah. And that's also, of course, true of information outlets, right? The ones that the billionaires set up, what's a couple more million dollars to them? Whereas organizations like Free Press, you don't have $50 million to give to Comcast and AT&T and Verizon to carry you on their faster service. It seems to me what it does is it just it gradually favors the biggest, richest, most predatory interests.
Yeah, absolutely. That's exactly what we see going on here, and that's why we think of this as a non-discrimination law. The internet has always been an open platform that anyone can use to start sharing their message, to sell their product, to talk to different people, to organize for change. And without net neutrality rules in place, we will instead see that the only voices being heard are the profitable ones, as opposed to anybody who has a story to tell.
Yeah, you know, I think of that in terms of things like this great struggle now in sports where mostly black athletes, but supported by a lot of white athletes, have supported the Black Lives Matter movement and other movements by people of color to fight back against what has been a sort of plantation mentality of the people on the top, as well as the use of lethal force to make sure that the communities stay oppressed and frightened. All of that would it would just not. The owners, of course, are apoplectic, as is Trump, that those voices are heard, and even sometimes get on TV. Not as much now as during the heyday of it, and they're sort of winning, but not as the big interests. But without net neutrality, in fact, those movements would have had a lot of trouble even starting and developing and building that audience and building that critical mass.
Right. I mean, Black Lives Matter started as a hashtag, and there have been so many of those stories that we have needed the internet to tell. Absolutely. The football player's stance, we saw the hashtag take a knee. We have the hashtag Me Too movement that's trying to bring attention to sexual assault. There's all of these different movements, standing with Standing Rock, that have used the internet to raise awareness, to connect people, to get donations and support for causes that are struggling, and to really help organize and start movements for change. Normally, it would be much harder for someone with a great idea and a passion to change things and to move our society in a more democratic direction to get on more traditional media platforms. But with the internet, they can go on, they can start using a hashtag, start talking to people online. And we've seen that create a lot of offline movement as well. We've seen, obviously, a lot of these movements grow into offline spaces because net neutrality gave them the freedom to set down their roots, to start speaking to people, to connect with enough people that you can actually make change.
Yeah, this is KBOO Radio, 90.7 FM, Bill Resnick here for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Dina Floberg of the organization Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund that have been fighting for net neutrality, not just in the last couple of years when the Obama administration finally, a 3-2 majority, passed the rules, but for a very long time, because it was very clear that a free and open internet was anathema to the forces on top of this society, who would really greatly prefer not allowing. Used to be in the 18th century, they would. Well, those are all stories of how people were divided ethnically and many other ways to fight one another rather than, in fact, demand a better share of the surplus of the wealth they were producing, sufficient to raise a family. That was not an interest of the people who ran things, and they did a pretty good job for a long time of keeping people divided. Now the internet has a tremendous potential for building that movement from below, and it appears that at least now the big predators have won a battle. What do we do? This is hardly won right now. It's going to anger many people, although it's going to be a complicated process. How are they going to respond, the big providers? I'm afraid that it's going to be very gradual. They're smart, and they know how to do things. Tell us about that. How will they respond, and how do we respond?
Yeah, I think we would expect that too. Right now, a lot of the providers have been saying, we don't need net neutrality rules because we promise we'll be good anyways. And so we expect that probably some of those violations will be slow in coming. They'll be subtle. They'll be sold in a way that tries to make it seem like it's some new creative thing, when in fact it's just Comcast charging you more for worse service. And the way that we think we have to respond to this is, one, we have to be vigilant and ready for when they make these violations, and two, we need to take them to court. Free Press will be suing the FCC to roll back the decision that they have made so that we can reinstate the strong net neutrality protections that the Obama-era FCC put in place. There's also energy on the Hill, where we have net neutrality supporters in Congress pushing CRA legislation that could effectively undo the FCC's recent decision and once again just put those rules back in place so that we can defend ourselves against the net neutrality violations that the big internet service providers want to pursue.
Yeah, you know, when you were talking, I thought, Gosh, yes, I know. If I were their PR person or Madison Avenue person, I would already be devising the ads for them. New choices for internet active people. All the new choices that you're getting. Of course, you have to pay a whole lot more, and it's at the expense of everybody else. My sense is that it's gonna take let me give you a hypothesis, that we build like Free Press and other, the ACLU, many others, who are fighting for free speech and free press and access and participation. And they affiliate with so many other organizations. We could have a tremendous movement, which if it takes in both the states and the at some point in the federal government, that would go way beyond just net neutrality would be a first step. It seems to me there are many other threats actually to speech that Free Press deals with. And why don't you? I'm sure you agree that that great movement is. We have to fight in the courts and the rest of it, and sometimes we can win. But that also can be part of the building of that movement. You have to struggle. The movements have to do something. But tell us about how Free Press operates. Net neutrality is part of it. There's so many other threats.
Right. A huge part of Free Press's goal is to try and bring the people and the public into these decision-making. And we've seen that a lot on net neutrality. We saw millions of people come out. We've seen hundreds of thousands of phone calls being made about net neutrality. And you're absolutely right. Net neutrality is so important because it is a first step to every other fight that we have to have. At Free Press, we fight for a media system that is going to protect and foster democracy, that is open for all. And there are a lot of barriers to that we've seen in traditional media, in new media, and there are a lot of different fights that have to be had to make sure that all voices can speak, that all voices can be heard, that we can do so without being surveilled, that we can do so without being censored. That everyone can do so regardless of how much money they have to pay for internet access or other media access. So all of these are important fights that we need, and one of the reasons that net neutrality is so critical is that it gives us the opportunity to have those fights and to organize for that change online so that we can build a better, more democratic media system all around and fight for all of these other issues beyond media reform to build a stronger democracy.
All right, Dina Floberg, thanks a lot. And this is KBOO Radio, of course, and we are one of those alternative sources that's always, in fact, threatened and challenged by insufficient funds, thanks to all who renewed or gave us a gift or became new members in our recent membership drive. And it's not too late to become a radio activist. Dina, it was really good talking to you. Thank you very much. Keep up the good work.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Right. Dina Floberg of Free Press and the Free Press Action Fund. If you want to donate to KBOO and them, just look both of us up on the web. We give you every opportunity. Thanks a lot for listening.
If you are the dealer, I'm out of the game. If you are the healer, means I'm broken and lame. If thine is the glory, then mine must be the shame. You want it darker? We kill the flame. Magnified, sanctified be thy holy name. Vilified, crucified in the human frame. A million candles burning for the help that never came. You want it darker? I'm ready.
This is KBOO Portland in the Old Mo Variety Hour. That was Leonard Cohen at his darkest. Let's hope he's not at his most prophetic. Coming up now, Denise Morris shares an article by Paul Street. What's not happening with Mr. Jones? Mr. Jones, of course, is Doug Jones, who recently defeated Roy Moore in the Alabama senatorial race. As Street reveals, it's not much of a victory.
I'd be lying if I didn't acknowledge that I'm relieved that the Christian fascist Alabama super freak Roy Moore won't be ascending into the United States Senate next year. Still, how excited do progressives really want to get about Doug Jones's special election victory over a candidate who was badly tarred with accusations of child molestation, a despicable and clownish predator whose pursuit of teenage girls in his 30s led to him being banned from a shopping mall? The apocalyptic, evangelical, racist, sexist Judge Roy Moore almost won, despite his epic handicap in the race. I found it strange, or at least disturbing, that nearly all of the national horror expressed about Roy Moore focused on his sexual crimes against white girls and women. His history as a sexual predator is horrific and richly worthy of condemnation and disgust, of course. But so was his all too tellingly neglected statement in Florence, Alabama last September, after a black citizen asked Moore when he thought America had last been great. "I think it was great," Moore said, "at a time when families were united. Even though we had slavery, they cared for one another. Our families were strong. The country had direction." It's not too often that you hear a politician contending for higher office pine for an era that included the vicious racist torture and exploitation system that was black chattel slavery, and a great stain on the nation that will never completely wash away. Why did Moore go to the pre-Civil War slave era when grasping for a time when America was supposedly great? Because its families were united? The usual reference point for Trumpian statements on past American greatness is the post-World War II golden age of unparalleled U.S. power and prosperity. But my guess is that that period didn't do it for Moore because it hatched the modern Southern Civil Rights Movement launched in Montgomery, Alabama in 1956. Liberals are awash with praise for the milquetoast Clinton, Obama, Pelosi, Schumer, moderate, and elite Democrat Jones, but it was black voters who marked ballots 98% for the candidate who did not pine for the good old days of slavery, who saved the United States from a new black eye in Alabama. Jones's triumph is not without progressive downsides. Beyond stating standard Democratic opposition to the arch-regressive Trump GOP tax bill and calling, along with moderate Republicans, for restored funding of the endangered federal children's health insurance program, Jones pretty much mimicked the 2016 Hillary campaign by running above all as not Roy Moore. Look at Mr. Jones's campaign advertisement titled Honor. It opens with scenes from the Civil War telling a story from the Battle of Gettysburg. "Those times have passed long ago," Jones says, "and our country is better for it. But now we fight too often over other matters. It seems as if we're coming apart. I want to go to Washington and meet the representatives from Maine and those from every other state, not on the battlefield, but to find common ground, because there's honor in compromise and civility, to pull together as people, and to get things done for Alabama. There'll be no silly, radical, and populist peoples or class or social justice warriorship from Doug Jones. Gee, Mr. Jones, does it seem like we're coming apart with, what, the top tenth of its upper U.S., 1% owning as much wealth as the nation's 90%? This while half the citizenry has no savings, half is living in or near poverty, 21% of U.S. children are growing up at less than the federal government's notoriously inadequate poverty level, and 41 million U.S. Americans, 12.3% of the population, are food insecure. And all this as Washington sits on the precipice of passing an arch plutocratic tax bill designed to make the new Gilded Age yet more viciously unequal and plutocratic? Though he certainly knew he could not defeat Moore without black votes, candidate Jones did not really take up the problem of the racist criminal justice, mass arrest, and incarceration system, or the nation's giant racial wealth and wage gap, or the endemic violation of black voting rights, or the savage, persistently separate and unequal status of black K through 12 education. Black Democrats simply got campaign calls telling them about Moore's sexual misconduct and reminding them that Jones once prosecuted the Ku Klux Klan members who bombed a black church in Birmingham. Along with the Democrats' off-year election victories in Virginia and elsewhere last month, Jones's narrow triumph reinforces the nation's disastrous attachment to narrow-spectrum two-party, major capitalist party electoral politics. As Chris Hedges noted in the summer of 2016, the predatory financial institutions on Wall Street will trash the economy and loot the U.S. Treasury on the way to another economic collapse, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is president. Poor unarmed people of color will be gunned down in the streets of our cities, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is president. Millions of undocumented people will be deported, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is president. Austerity programs will cut or abolish public services, further decay the infrastructure, and curtail social programs, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is president. Money will replace the vote, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton is president. And half the country, which now lives in poverty, will remain in misery, whether Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton becomes president. This is not speculation. We know this because there has been total continuity over every issue, from trade agreements to war to mass deportations, between the Bush administration and the administration of Barack Obama. The problem is not Donald Trump. The problem is capitalism. And this is the beast we are called to fight and slay. Until that is done, nothing of substance will change. To reduce the political debate, as Bernie Sanders and others are doing, to political personalities is political infantilism. We have undergone a corporate coup. Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton will not reverse this coup. They, like Barack Obama, know where the centers of power lie. They serve these centers of power, as will Mr. Jones. And as Howard Zinn reminded us, historically, government, whether in the hands of Republicans or Democrats, conservatives or liberals, has failed its responsibilities until forced by direct action. Sit-ins and freedom rides for the rights of black people, strikes and boycotts for the rights of workers, mutinies and desertions of soldiers in order to stop war. Voting is easy and marginally useful, but it is a poor substitute for democracy, which requires direct action by concerned citizens. This has been Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour, and I've been reading from an article by Paul Street on counterpunch.org titled, What's Not Happening with Mr. Jones?
And this is the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. The following are excerpts from an article entitled, The U.S. is Not a Democracy, It Never Was, by Gabriel Rockhill. Nor, I might add, as Rockhill makes clear, was it ever intended to be. One of the most steadfast beliefs regarding the United States is that it is a democracy. Whenever this conviction wavers slightly, it is almost always to point out detrimental exceptions to core American values or foundational principles. For instance, aspiring critics frequently bemoan a loss of democracy due to the election of clownish autocrats, draconian measures on the part of the state, the revelation of extraordinary malfeasance or corruption, deadly foreign interventions, or other such activities that are considered undemocratic exceptions. The same is true for those whose critical framework consists in always juxtaposing the actions of the U.S. government to its founding principles, highlighting the contradiction between the two and clearly placing hope in its potential resolution. The problem, however, is that there is no contradiction or supposed loss of democracy, because the United States simply never was one. This is a difficult reality for many people to confront, and they're likely more inclined to immediately dismiss such a claim as preposterous, rather than take the time to scrutinize the historical record in order to see for themselves. Such a dismissive reaction is due in large part to what is perhaps the most successful public relations campaign in modern history. What will be seen, however, if this record is soberly and methodically inspected, is that a country founded on a weak colonial rule based on the power of wealth, a plutocratic colonial oligarchy, in short, has succeeded not only in buying the label of democracy to market itself to the masses, but in having its citizenry and many others so socially and psychologically invested in its national origin myth that they refuse to hear lucid and well-documented arguments to the contrary. To begin to peel the scales from our eyes, let us list patent reasons why the United States has never been a democracy. To begin with, British colonial expansion into the Americas did not occur in the name of the freedom and equality of the general population or the conferral of power to the people. Those who settled on the shores of the New World, with few exceptions, did not respect the fact that it was a very old world indeed, and that a vast indigenous population had been living there for centuries. As soon as Columbus set foot, Europeans began robbing, enslaving, and killing the native inhabitants. Second, when the elite colonial ruling class decided to sever ties from their homeland and establish an independent state for themselves, they did not found it as a democracy. On the contrary, they were fervently and explicitly opposed to democracy, like the vast majority of European Enlightenment thinkers. They understood it to be a dangerous and chaotic form of uneducated mob rule. For the so-called founding fathers, the masses were not only incapable of ruling, but they were considered a threat to the hierarchical social structures purportedly necessary for good governance. It is in this context that Patrick Henry flatly proclaimed the most lucid of judgments: it is not a democracy. George Mason further clarified the situation by describing the newly independent country as a despotic aristocracy. George Mason, by the way, was a delegate to the U.S. Constitutional Convention of 1887, who refused to sign the Constitution. When the American Republic slowly came to be relabeled as a democracy, there were no significant institutional modifications to justify the change in name. In other words, and this is the third point, the use of the term democracy to refer to an oligarchic republic simply meant that a different word was being used to describe the same basic phenomenon. In spite of certain minor changes over time, the U.S. Republic has doggedly preserved its oligarchic structure, and this is readily apparent in the two major selling points of its contemporary Democratic publicity campaign. The establishment and its propagandists regularly insist that a structural aristocracy is a democracy because the latter is defined by the guarantee of certain fundamental rights, legal definition, and the holding of regular elections, procedural definition. This, of course, is a purely formal, abstract, and largely negative understanding of democracy, which says nothing whatsoever about people having real, sustained power over the governing of their lives. Multivariate analysis indicates, according to an important recent study, that economic elites and organized groups representing business interests have substantial independent impacts on U.S. government policy, while average citizens and mass-based interest groups have little or no independent influence. The results provide substantial support for theories of economic elite domination, but not for theories of majoritarian electoral democracy. To take but a final example of the myriad ways in which the U.S. is not and has never been a democracy, it is worth highlighting its consistent assault on movements of people power. Since World War II, it has endeavored to overthrow some 50 foreign governments, most of which were democratically elected. It is also, according to the meticulous calculations by William Blum in America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, grossly interfered in the elections of at least 30 countries, attempted to assassinate more than 50 foreign leaders, dropped bombs on more than 30 countries, and attempted to suppress populist movements in 20 countries. The record on the home front is just as brutal. To take but one significant parallel example, there is ample evidence that the FBI has been invested in a covert war against democracy. Beginning at least in the 1960s and likely continuing up to the present, the Bureau extended its earlier clandestine operations against the Communist Party, committing its resources to undermining the Puerto Rico independence movement, the Socialist Workers Party, the Civil Rights Movement, Black Nationalist Movements, segments of the Peace Movement, the Student Movement, and the New Left in general. In the case of the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement, which were both important attempts to mobilize people power to dismantle the structural oppression of white supremacy and top-down class warfare, the FBI not only infiltrated them and launched hideous smear and destabilization campaigns against them, but they assassinated 27 Black Panthers and 69 members of the American Indian Movement, and subjected countless others to the slow death of incarceration. If it be abroad or at home, or on the home front, the American secret police is extremely proactive in beating down the movements of people rising up, thereby protecting and preserving the main pillars of white supremacist capitalist aristocracy. Rather than blindly believing in a golden age of democracy in order to remain at all costs within the gilded age of an ideology produced specifically for us by well-paid spin doctors of a plutocratic oligarchy, we should unlock the gates of history and meticulously scrutinize the founding and evolution of the American Imperial Republic. There is a radical America just below the surface of these nationalist narratives, an America in which the population autonomously organizes itself in indigenous and ecological activism, black radical resistance, anti-capitalist mobilization, anti-patriarchal struggles, and so forth. Is this America that the corporate republic has sought to eradicate while simultaneously investing in an expansive public relations campaign to cover over its crimes with the fig leaf of democracy? Indeed, if the United States is not a democracy today, it's in large part due to the fact that it never was one. Far from being a pessimistic conclusion, Rockwell concludes, however, it is precisely by cracking open the hard shell of ideological encasement that we can tap into the radical forces that have been suppressed by it. These forces, not those that have been deployed to destroy them, should be the ultimate source of our pride in the power of the people. That was an article from Gabriel Rockhill entitled, The U.S. is Not a Democracy, It Never Was. Gabriel Rockhill is a Franco-American philosopher and cultural critic. He is associate professor of philosophy at Villanova University. The much longer article can be found on the Counterpunch webpage. A more sustained argument can be found in his new book, A Counter History of the Present.
Just like a river, I've been a running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change don't come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living. Beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes, it will. I'm closer than Billy. Somebody always telling me don't
That was Bob Dylan live at the Apollo Theater in Harlem on the occasion of its 70th anniversary celebration, singing the song made famous by Sam Cooke, a note of measured optimism to counter Cohen's darkness. Now concluding our program today, Jan Hocken talks with Katie Gentile about feminist politics, sexual harassment, and the Me Too campaign. Gentile is a professor of gender studies at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York City and author of several books, including The Business of Being Made, her recent work that focuses on reproductive technologies. They discuss insights from black feminists on how to think about race, class, and gender, and the dynamics of sexual harassment.
Katie Gentile, welcome to KBOO.
Hi, Jan. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, you've taken on a number of issues as a feminist scholar, including reproductive rights and the problem of sexual assault on college campuses. And in the midst of right-wing assaults on pretty much everything associated with progress these days, the recent feminist campaign against sexual harassment seems, for many of us, a kind of singular beacon of light in an otherwise dark night of politics. So let's start by talking about the Senate victory last week of Doug Jones in Alabama and the role of sexual politics in that case. The victory by Democrat Jones against Republican, not reproductive rights, Roy Moore, was fueled by the series of stories and allegations against Moore for sexual abuse of teenagers. Well, let's start with that dramatic victory and what many recognize as the vital role of African-American voters in Alabama in defeating Moore. What do you think were some of the critical political dynamics here? And then perhaps we can move to talking about the role of black feminist thought in working through not only allegations against men accused of sexual assault or sexual misconduct, but also how to think about feminist ways of addressing the problem. So let's start with that that Senate victory last week. What's your take on it?
Well, I think you introduced it really well, because there's so many issues in that. But I think what I was struck by, and I'm sure you were as well, is just the ways in which the moral panic around his behavior with teenage girls, white teenage girls in particular, and which was, you know, obviously not okay, horrible. But this the press really, when they did discuss it, they discussed that. And what seemed to get ignored was the fact that this was also a candidate who believed in criminalizing homosexuality, which is very different than saying I'm not pro-gay marriage. I mean, criminalizing homosexuality is going back, you know, decades in our law books. So that was one thing that he believed in. And then the other thing was his comments about how families were so much more coherent and supportive of each other during slavery. So you've got this candidate who in that sense is really, it cries out for an intersectional analysis and solidarity across not just white women, but all women, across issues of sexuality, race, class. And it seemed like when you looked at the voting polls, in fact, that just didn't happen. And white women were more apt to vote for Roy Moore. And, and it was the black women who were able to see more intersectionally about the issues.
And Doug Jones had kind of made his name as a U.S. attorney over a decade ago when he successfully prosecuted members of the Ku Klux Klan for the 1963 bombing of a Birmingham church in Alabama that killed four black girls. And that that was part of his campaign, but was not so much at the center of the larger national campaign around the urgency of this Senate victory for Jones.
No, I mean, the thing, while on one hand I'm, like you said, there's a certain really curious, interesting reckoning that might be happening. But the reckoning seems to be ignoring issues of race, just like the press ignored, you know, his very significant history in the role of civil rights. It's kind of insane that the press wasn't talking about that.
Yeah, and I think also the issues around power in the workplace that have been so important in thinking about in the history of legislation on sexual harassment, that it extends to the workplace, and issues of power and economic control men have over women in the workplace, that Black feminists have contributed an important insights in extending the workplace to the home, which also was part of the domestic violence
right.
campaigns, was thinking about the home as a workplace, but also that Black women have a history of household work now in the service industry that is subject to also not only the harassment and sexual exploitation by white men, but also of white women in the workplace. How do you draw on some of these insights in thinking in more complex ways about sexual harassment in the workplace, and what we can learn from this current period beyond the collective state of outrage and calling to bring down or sack these men, have them fired from their jobs?
Well, I think it's whether or not they deserve to be fired, there's really, you know, it can't be a bad apple scenario where all the badness and all the problems are located in that one body. I mean, we have such a neoliberal response to these things. And
you mean in terms of thinking about very individualist solutions,
yeah.
And where the denouement is a kind of collective catharsis? Well, we brought down a mighty man and expelled him from our midst, and therefore we can all feel a virtuous sense of relief.
Right, right. Yes, a very virtuous sense of relief. Yeah. And that's super dangerous, because it obviously isn't going to change the dynamics of power and control that support this kind of behavior and other forms of bullying, as you said, around race, class, sexual orientation, and gender conformity. So, I mean, I think that part of the problem, you know, looking at actually going back to Fanon's idea that the colonized carry the shameful affects of the colonizer, and if we look at the way power is used oftentimes to shame the powerless, then we can take it out of the realm. We can see it more as an operation of power to dehumanize the other, whether it's a white woman being dehumanized by a white man, or white women dehumanizing women of color in different workplace scenarios or other forms of scenarios. So I think that seeing this as a power structure problem and not as an individual problem is key. And Black feminist thought has done a better job in a lot of ways undermining or kind of deconstructing the ways in which white women in particular are still often motivated to protect to hold the shame for white men, and to also seek men's approval before their own solidarity or collective action. And that is always going to stop us from making strides towards a more equal workplace.
And that has concerned me some with daily reports and outrageous stories of Trump and the other guys like him, you know, who are fascinating in their outrageous disregard of kind of the most basic aspects of what we've thought of as civility, and the ways in which old forms of patriarchy had a kind of chivalry attached to them, and no more of that is on display.
Yeah.
But there can be a fascination with these powerful men. And seeking recognition from them, and in the, and then cast to the shadows are all the ways in which we as women are sometimes implicated in those, and propping up power, and sometimes with very few degrees of freedom and choice, which of course is always a point made, but. To me, coming into feminism in the 70s, I was very aware of it, that it required something of us as women, as cis women, as well as of men, in thinking about turning to men for recognition and where we turned and how to work through all of the painful differences we bring to feminism through our various histories.
Yeah. I mean, I think you know, having been influenced by 70s feminism and feminist thought, I mean, there is more, not, I won't say more, but the focus on the community and finding spaces of self-worth that might contradict the dominant culture, seems to be very, very radical and hard to do, hard to come by in a culture of, just, you know, increasing commodification of an objectification of the female body, and linking commodification and objectification to some form of power, even though it's a spurious form of power or an incomplete form of power, because it doesn't change the system. And that's part of the problem. I mean, you see some of these men who've been toppled, let's say, and there's no way there wasn't a team behind them maintaining the collusion. And that included women and men, who were oftentimes most likely in kind of no-win situations in terms of losing their job if they opened their mouths. I mean, there was a quote from somebody who worked at one of the radio stations that was implicated that said, "We all knew if you open your mouth, you will disappear." And that's really terrifying.
And that points, I think, to workplace forms of organizing, how to think about the role of unions, which are now involved in some of the issues around hotel workers, organizing around sexual assault of hotel workers, and thinking about enlisting men as comrades around workplace grievances that have been more difficult, too, with the decline of unions and other workplace sites of self-organization. And so as more people are isolated, including women, and the prospects of employment seem so fragile, I think that also is perhaps part of what we need to address as feminists.
Yeah, and even the shift from unions talk about members and workers, and, you know, the tax bill talks about creating jobs. Well, creating jobs is not the same as creating workers. These are very different things. So we live in a culture that creates jobs, and these jobs are based on really no rights for the worker. And then you've got, in the case of sexual harassment on the job, you've got a massive form of institutional betrayal, no job security, and maybe HR, if you're in an organization that has a human resource department that is even local. I mean, many corporations are so large now that human resources might be in a different state. You don't know. And then human resources is the instrument of the institution. I mean, no matter how good that human resources person might be who's supposedly handling these forms of sexual misconduct, whatever you want to call it, they're still being paid by the corporation.
So let's continue this conversation about sexual harassment as a symptom of deeper problems of gender, race, and hierarchy in workplaces, and how to organize beyond kind of the collective outrage that is always part of a social movement, but not enough. Thank you so much, Katie Gentile, for being with us today on the Olmo Variety Hour.
Thank you, and thank you for all your work.
You too.
Okay.
Carry it on.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And that concludes our program for today. You've been listening to the Olmo Variety Hour. I'm Tom Becker. Katsi Kohlberg has been our engineer. Every Monday, the Olmo brings you an hour of political, social, and cultural commentary from the mole's point of view, that is, from the ground up. As Moles will seek to explore alternative possibilities for our cultural, social, and political lives, to move beyond the hegemony of unfettered global capitalism and a culture of consumerism, exploitation, and environmental devastation, we agitate for a new order in which not only humanity, but other species as well, can thrive and lead fulfilling lives within ecologically sustainable environments. From the Moles' perspective, such effective change can only come about through grassroots democratic struggles to chip away at existing power structures in an effort to create more just and equitable communities, both locally and internationally. So tune in next Monday for more interviews, reviews, and commentaries that reflect the old Mole mission. This entire program will be on the KBOO website in the next day or two. Now stay tuned at 10. On Wokus Focus, Barbara Bernstein talks to journalist and explorer Edward Struzik about his book, Firestorm, How Wildfire Will Shape Our Future. At 11, it's Intersections Radio. Sarika talks to Needy Chanani about her celebrated graphic novel, Pasmina. And at 11:30, Radio Zine presents Between the Lines, a radio news magazine, and the world's reaction to Trump's Jerusalem declaration. Tonight, at 5 on KBOO Evening News, an in-depth segment featuring author Bobby Arellano and his book, Havana Libra. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee will meet December 21st at 4:30.
KBOO is in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. KBOO has inspired and supported communities for nearly 50 years. You were an important part of this work, and your gift to KBOO builds fiercely just, creative, and independent radio. Join your friends and neighbors in supporting KBOO in the Give Guide. It's easy and secure. Help us make our $18,000 goal before December 31st. Go to the giveguide.org website and find KBOO in the Creative Expression section. And as always, thank you for your support of KBOO.
KBOO Portland.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.